Hello everyone and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
When they kill Jamal, they kill also my future. They kill also my hope.
Jamal Khashoggi's widow keeps fighting for justice. We talk to Hatice Cengiz, who features in the new documentary about the Saudi journalist's murder. It's called The Dissident, and its director Brian Fogel will be with us. Plus, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo on a farewell visit to Israel. Journalist Ronan Bergman breaks down the foreign policy agenda of this trip. Then,
I don't think it's fair to blame us. And I think it actually is a distraction to blame Black Lives Matter for the democratic losses.
Politics and protests. Black Lives Matter co-founder Patrice Cullors tells our Michelle Martin how the Democratic Party can embrace the movement.
Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. G20 leaders are getting ready for a virtual summit this weekend hosted by Saudi Arabia. And human rights organizations are calling once more for the release of jailed dissidents and activists, especially women, of course, but also accountability for journalist Jamal Khashoggi, who was brutally murdered for his calls for reform in the kingdom. A new documentary, The Dissident, retraces his life and his career from insider to outcast. And his widow, Hatice Cengiz, features in the documentary. And she has also called on world leaders to boycott this Saudi summit. I've been talking to her about her continuing fight for justice. Hatice Cengiz, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Hatice, let me ask you, it's just over 2 years since Jamal was so brutally murdered. I just want to know how you are doing and what you are feeling right now today.
I'm feeling more hopeful, more powerful than before. And I'm doing well. And I'm keep remembering Jamal, and I'm speak out with the whole world, around the world. I'm going to speak the parliaments and the people who care this issue still.
Fantastic. Let me ask you about the film then, because you took part in The Dissident, as it's called, and just several months after the terrible murder, and there's a scene where you are inside your apartment, the police have been there, all yours and Jamal's, you know, stuff is all over the place. I just want to know how this film and speaking out has helped you.
You can't imagine how difficult was it. But at the same time, look, Christian, I was dreaming such a love and happiness that finally I found with Jamal. Then suddenly they took away from me. It was taken away from me. So that's why it was a very, very difficult time. At the same time, it's a very significant time in my life, because the film now talks about story. And the film will make Jamal's story and legacy alive. So that's why, you know, the truth mostly or always painful. So, and I decide to speak out and then speak with the people, and then the world needs to understand what happened. I'm satisfied with that film, and then Brian did a very, very good job. And then we whole people around him stayed with him, and then we helped him, and we helped Jamal spread, and it was very, very, very good job with him.
You've been quite brave. You talked about speaking to parliaments. You've addressed, I believe, the German parliament. You've addressed the British parliament. What are you telling them? What did you address them for?
I am remembering what happened with Jamal, and I'm asking this question. Why you are doing like nothing happened? And now the G20 summit taking place, and you are the partner of this summit. Why or how you are sitting the same table with someone order the killing Jamal or what's happening in their country unacceptable, and no one punished them, and there is no trial in their country, and they covered this crime, and you are, as a partners, they, you help them.
Just so that I get it clear, you want them to boycott the G20, which is happening this weekend, virtually?
Yes, of course. I'm asking this. I'm asking, it's how we can expect this situation now you are gathering right now as a G20 summit. At the same time, they have trial in Turkey against that, those guys, that administration in Turkey at the same time in the USA. And you guys, international community, doing something like nothing happened.
Of course, this G20 summit is hosted by Saudi Arabia, and that's your issue. And it's coming out of Riyadh. You have also, and your group, Dawn, you are suing Saudi Arabia, you're suing MBS, as he's known, and you're seeking damages and you want justice. They say they've put people on trial and they've convicted them. What do you hope to get out of this?
Yes, I hope I find justice after this struggle, because already they changed my life 100%. When they kill Jamal, they kill also my future. They kill also my hope. They kill also my dreams. So now, why we are keep doing the same relation and business and the politics and any friendship with those guys? So the G20 summit will, if they boycott or if they take or give any statement at the same time at the beginning of the G20, it will be very big answer for them. And then we will say with that, we did not forget what happened, Jamal. And then also there is another cases in the Saudi Arabia, by the way. I'm not talking about Jamal's case, just Jamal case, because there is no hope Jamal will not come again. But there is some hope for the other guys in the jail right now. So that's why I keep pushing them to boycott those killers.
Do you have any hope for a new president-elect in the United States, Biden and Harris? What do you hope that they will do differently?
Absolutely, absolutely. I have hope, because if you remember when President Trump invited me to White House, I refused because I did not believe he will do something through justice and or help me in this case. And then now Biden has elected recently, and then there is a new page and new hope for us and for all of us. And then, so I will be happy if I meet with Biden administration and then talk about this issue again. And already he promised when he was in the election campaign, he will do something. So I am ready to meet with him. So it's a hope, of course. It's a new page and new hope for all of us.
You know what? It's so encouraging to hear you being optimistic after all that you've suffered. And Jamal lives on. Hatice Cengiz, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Kristen.
And of course, she is relentless in her pursuit of justice. And my next guest is the dissident director himself, Brian Fogel. He explores the life, the murder, and the dismemberment of Khashoggi. And the powerful documentary is scheduled to be released in theaters on December 18th. Here's a bit of the trailer.
Jamal Khashoggi, prominent Saudi journalist and Washington Post columnist, has gone missing after visiting his country's consulate in Istanbul.
He was last seen entering Saudi Arabia's consulate, seeking paperwork to marry his fiancée.
His fiancée saw him go in at 1 p.m. and was still waiting for him at 1 a.m.
Buhar olup uçmadı.
Saudi Arabia now suddenly is admitting that Khashoggi did die inside that building.
So Fogel's last documentary, Icarus, exposed the Russian doping scandal and won the Academy Award for Best Documentary Feature in 2018. And he's joining me now from Los Angeles. Brian, welcome back to the program. You have done some really amazing, game-changing documentaries. I wonder what made you want to do this one, tackle this issue? And how was the relationship with Hatice? Because it was so difficult for her so soon after this brutal murder.
Well, I'd followed this story, I think, as the rest of the world had in the days of following Jamal's disappearance within the Saudi consulate. And as I read each day, I became more, spellbound by this horrendous crime. And when Saudi Arabia, in fact, admitted that Jamal had, in fact, died inside that consulate, I believe that was on October 15th or October 16th, I thought that this could be my next film. And the variable for me was if I could build trust with Hatice Cengiz, with Omar Abdulaziz, and the Turks who were investigating this murder. I got in touch with Hatice beginning of November. Obviously, she was grieving terribly at that time, but she invited me to come meet her in Istanbul. And I stayed in Istanbul for those next 5 weeks, not shooting, without a camera, but just meeting Hatice for coffees, for lunches, for dinners, and building a friendship with her, which ultimately began filming together in February.
And she really has become this prominent figure for human rights and justice, and she's not letting up, even knowing how dangerous it could be to confront the Saudi government, the Saudi monarchy. I want to just take you back a little bit, because you talked about the Turkish authorities. They provided you with amazing interviews and firsthand evidence and film for the film. But also you talk about Omar Abdulaziz. So we have a little clip, and this is because he's, I think, one of the dissidents that creates or is part of the circle around Khashoggi, who moved, you know, from being a monarchist insider to a reformer. We've got a tiny little clip about Abdulaziz, and we'll talk about it.
Beginning of September, Jamal told me that he's planning to come to Canada. He said, I have a few things to do in Turkey. Then I'm coming to meet you. And we set the plan of the peace together.
That was our strategy.
Okay, so it's pretty mysterious. The bees, our strategy. Explain that and what Omar, you know, thought he was going to get from Khashoggi, who obviously never turned up because he was murdered in the interim.
Well, Omar is a young Saudi dissident living in self-exile in Montreal. And basically, the Saudis came to rendition him back to Saudi Arabia, much like they were planning to do with Jamal. And he was working with Jamal on a program basically that they called the Bees, which essentially Saudi Arabia has taken control of Twitter in the country. And the vast majority of a country gets their news, and they call it essentially the parliament of Saudi Arabia, because there is no free speech, there is no democracy, there is no free press. And what Omar and Jamal was working on is basically how to take over the Twitter narrative that essentially the flies, the Saudi Twitter trolls, I guess, as you would call them, had been successfully taking over Twitter with the pro-MBS narrative, but also suppressing freedom of speech within that country. And so the Bees was Jamal and Omar's plan as to how they could take back the narrative on Twitter and bring freedom of expression and speech to the Saudi people.
And then, I mean, that was underway. And then the sort of momentum that you show building up in the film towards Jamal's murder. And let's not forget, he never preached violence. He never preached any radical upheaval or overthrow. He just wanted reform, as you say, particularly on freedom of expression and rights, human rights and political rights. Just what did you sort of discover, especially talking to the Turkish officials, of what led to that terrible day, October 2nd, 2 years ago?
Well, the reason I believe that they ultimately murdered Jamal is, as you'll see in the film The Dissident, they had hacked both Omar Abdulaziz and Jamal Khashoggi with software called Pegasus, which is an Israeli company that sells cyber hacking software. And by hacking their phones, they were able to actually have access to Jamal's Twitter messaging, his text messaging, everything on his phone, same with Omar. And the Saudis realized that Omar and Jamal were in fact working on this plan that they called the Bees, and that Jamal had actually really kind of began to assert himself as a more vocal dissident of the kingdom and a very vocal a criticizer of MBS. And I think because Jamal had such a huge following, he had 1.75 million followers on Twitter and was such a respected voice in the region, they viewed his criticism as a threat to the monarchy, and MBS has decided to run the country as a dictatorship. And under a dictatorship, there is no freedom of speech. And Jamal, they viewed as a threat, but not a physical threat, a threat to influence opinions.
So I've got to, you know, do due diligence here. Pegasus, the hacking software that you're talking about, is developed by, it's called the NSA Group, and they've put a statement out saying that their technology is only licensed to government, intelligence, and law enforcement agencies for the sole purpose of preventing and investigating terror and serious crime. NSO's governance framework sets the highest standards in the cyber intelligence industry and aligns us with the UN guiding principles on business and human rights, embedding human rights due diligence into everything we do. You know, Saudi Arabia denies all of this, but you have sort of irrefutable proof that it was that technology.
Yes, but part of that statement that you have to look at is that they say that they sell only to governments. Mm-hmm. And yes, they sold to the Saudi government. And that contract had to be approved by the Israeli Defense Ministry to sell these cyber hacking tools. But in Israel essentially approving that sale, they're also gaining intelligence into what, in fact, Saudi Arabia is interested in and who, in fact, they are hacking. But if you research NSO, you'll see there has been multiple cases, not just in Saudi Arabia, out of Africa, out of Mexico, and many, many other countries around the world that have had, you know, dictatorships, autocratic regimes, right, where they have sold this technology, and this technology has been used to go after dissidents or go after political opponents. Right. So Brian, NSO's state is a lie.
And we have tried over and over and again to get reaction to your film and to, you know, what you've laid out there from Saudi authorities. We approached several times the Saudi embassy in Washington, D.C., and they have not responded. So I'm just going to put out a little soundbite, an excerpt of an interview I did with then Foreign Minister Adel Al-Jubeir about a year and a bit ago on the murder of Jamal Khashoggi.
We have made it very clear that this was a rogue operation that was not authorized. The king ordered an investigation. The investigation led to exposing the truth, that the fact that Jamal Khashoggi was murdered in the Saudi consulate by officials who exceeded their authority and had no mandate to do so. Those individuals were arrested and they were charged, and they're facing trial as we speak.
So bring us up to date with any kind of accountability that Foreign Minister said was happening. Remember, this was about 18 months ago.
I mean, the statement is absurd. You know, first of all, as Agnes Callamard, the UN Special Rapporteur, and even the CIA and British intelligence have all basically confirmed beyond any reasonable shadow of a doubt that the order to murder Jamal was, in fact, approved by MBS. When you look at a kingdom, nobody can make that high level of a decision without the approval of either the king or the crown prince. Okay. It's impossible. And when you look at the kill team that came there and that they were using private jets owned by the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, traveling on diplomatic passports, members of a team are part of MBS's security detail, on and on and on. It's an absurd statement. But okay. As to Saudi Arabia holding these individuals accountable, again, this trial was held in secret. Members of the press were not allowed into the trial. And so we don't even know exactly who was tried. And it's now been revealed that these death sentences about 2 months ago have been reversed for prison terms as one of the members of Khashoggi's family have said that he has forgiven the killers, clearly under pressure from the kingdom.
So, Brian, I need to ask you about the U.S. because the Trump administration has a very close relationship with Saudi Arabia. It all fits into their Middle East policy, particularly, against Iran, etc. And this is what President Trump said about the murder of Jamal Khashoggi more than a month after he was killed. The crime against Jamal Khashoggi was a terrible one, one our country does not condone. Representatives of Saudi Arabia say that Jamal Khashoggi was an enemy of the state and a member of the Muslim Brotherhood. It could very well be that the Crown Prince had knowledge of this tragic event. Maybe he did, and maybe he didn't, which became a very famous strategy by President Trump to throw stuff out there and see where it stuck. What do you think the U.S. reaction to this has meant in these years since?
Well, I mean, to follow up on that, in Bob Woodard's book, he has audio of Trump literally stating and boasting that he, quote, saved MBS's ass. So not only was the United States or the Trump administration aware of the CIA intelligence on this murder, the Trump administration made a deliberate choice to help MBS push this murder under the carpet. And I think what you saw is other members of the G20 take their lead from the United States, which was if the Trump administration was going to not enact sanctions, was not going to seek punishment in this murder, then it was okay for other countries to essentially continue to do business with Saudi as planned. And when you look at the amount of weapons sales and the hundreds of billions of dollars on the line, this comes down to a business decision rather than a decision doing right by humanity or human rights.
Well, we're going to talk more about that aspect of it with our next guest. But Brian Fogel, thank you so much. And again, the film comes out in just over a month. Now, as we said, we reached out to the Saudi government for a response to this documentary, and they have declined to comment. And the U.S. Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, will head to Saudi Arabia for that G20 summit. But today, he was in Israel, where he became the highest-ranking American official ever to visit an Israeli settlement in the West Bank. The Trump administration's strong support for Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has been a hallmark of its foreign policy. And, of course, the two share a common foe, Iran. Now, in the waning days of Donald Trump's presidency, come reports that he had asked for options for an attack against Iran, an idea that many foreign policy experts viewed as disastrous and could prove a critical problem for a Biden administration. So let's dig down into all of this. And joining me now from Tel Aviv is the New York Times staff reporter, Ronan Bergman. Ronan, welcome back to the program.
Hi, Christian. Thank you for the invite.
So, look, let me ask you, today has been billed, or these last 2 days, as sort of a farewell trip by the American administration to Israel, particularly Mike Pompeo, maybe a parting gift to Benjamin Netanyahu. What do you think was the biggest conversation, the most important issue that they needed to sort of sort out and settle right now at this time?
I think it will revolve, as Benjamin Netanyahu used to say, he will always speak about three topics: Iran, Iran, and Iran. And these are the topics that the most important ones. The U.S., as you mentioned, the U.S. administration, the current U.S. administration, and the Netanyahu government were holding very, very close relationship. And in that context, they were thinking of new ways to enforce withdrawals and disassemblement of the nuclear project on Iran. Israel, as we reported in the New York Times, was able to sabotage the main facility for balancing of centrifuges in the nuclear site in Natanz just during the summer, and there were other actions that were taking place. We can assume that they were discussing possible actions, possible policies. Is there still a room for the administrations to do something in the 2 months, less than 2 months, that are still left and exercise a tougher policy, much tougher than they believe the president-elect will adopt once in the Oval Office?
So you must have been across it. I mean, it came out of the New York Times, and you do so much work on this issue. This idea, as it's been reported, that President Trump had asked his officials for options to strike parts of the nuclear project in Iran, and that apparently he was dissuaded. Can you fill in any of those blanks?
The prominent figures at both administrations during the last 2 years, and I think that Secretary of State Pompeo is clearly one of them, if not leading this school of thought, started to believe that there is very little hope to bring regime change, even with economic pressure, even with maximum pressure, as the former National Security Advisor Bolton phrased that. And if there is no regime change, then the only way is to coerce the current administration to in Iran, the current government, to do what the West, what the United States and Israel wanted them to do. So to, again, take out much of their, or disassemble much of their nuclear facilities and do or diminish or cancel their support to insurgencies in the Middle East. And they have started a new strategy that was calling to pinpoint operations way beyond enemy lines. I don't think that overt aerial strike is one of them, but trying to target again and again facilities and sabotage them is part of that strategy. And I might believe that President Trump was not asking or was not seeking for options to bomb, but maybe to options to plant a bomb. The result is the same, but the method is very different.
So we know that Vice President, President-elect Joe Biden has telegraphed that he would like to get the United States back into the JCPOA, otherwise known as the Iran nuclear deal, which Israel opposed. Is this all about trying to create facts on the ground, including the sanctions that they've just talked about, and they've just launched more sanctions, to make that either impossible or more difficult?
Well, I assume that President Trump, like any outgoing president, would like to leave a legacy. But there's something more. There was no Secretary of State that was so friendly towards the Israeli government like Secretary of State Pompeo. People say that he's looking at the 2024 elections, where he might be presenting himself as candidate for presidency. But the channel, not just between Trump, President Trump, and Prime Minister Netanyahu, but also the channel, the secret channel, between Secretary of State Pompeo and the chief of the Israeli Mossad, Yossi Cohen, who knew Mr. Pompeo from the times that he was the chief of the CIA. That channel, the planning, the views, the common views on how to handle Iran, had a profound influence on the U.S. and Israeli foreign policy. And I think what they are trying to do is to leave the situation as close as possible to what the U.S. administration would have done if President Trump would continue to a second term.
You also talking about this close connection. You reported about at the behest of the United States, Israel took out an Al Qaeda figure who had been apparently under house arrest or in Iran. Give me the details on that, sort of tightly.
Right. So together with my great colleagues at the New York Times, Eric Schmidt, Adam Goldman, and Farnaz Fasihi, we published on Saturday that Mossad was able to locate, trace down in Tehran, living under false identity, the second in command of Al-Qaeda, Abu Muhammad al-Masri, The person who was directly in charge of the bombing of the two American embassies in Dar es Salaam and Nairobi in 1998. And on the day, the 22nd anniversary, on the day, almost on the hour of the bombings, on the behest of the United States, Mossad agents killed him. They were riding a motorcycle. He was sitting in his car with his daughter, Mariam, the widow of Hamza bin Laden, the son of Osama bin Laden that was supposed to inherit him, but died himself in American assassination in 2019. Two Mossad assassins on a motorcycle approached him. They knew that he is not a Lebanese history scholar as the documentation that the Revolutionary Guard gave him, but he is in fact Mr. El-Masri. They pulled a gun with a silencer, fired five bullets, one hit the nearby car, four their car, killing both of them. The Iranians and Al-Qaeda, and surprisingly, I must say, United States and Israel as well, kept it tightly in their safe and didn't tell anyone. The Iranians were highly embarrassed and knew that this is going to create external and domestic rage. Why have they given shelter to someone that they themselves described as Satan himself? So as Sunni Al-Qaeda senior commander.
And let me just talk, bring it out to what we were just talking about with my previous guests about the Saudi Arabia, you know, all this business about the, you know, Israel normalizing relations with the UAE, Bahrain, Sudan, mm-hmm. etc. As you know, some have suggested that these are not peace agreements; these are sort of arms deals. And to that point, the administration has announced plans, as you know, to sell some $23 billion worth of sophisticated weapons to the UAE after the normalization. A group of U.S. senators, Republicans and Democrats, oppose it, saying that it will seriously destabilize an already volatile region and potentially put Israel at risk. How is that sale, including these highly sophisticated, what I think they're F-35s or something like that, affect the balance of power in that region? And is Israel going along with this? Do they mind?
Well, first, I think we should not underestimate. There is an achievement, and the achievement belonged mainly to President Trump, and some of it to, as I mentioned, Mossad Chief Yossi Cohen and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. They convinced three Arab countries to put aside their main demand for normalization and for public relations with Israel, which was a significant advancement on the Palestinian-Israeli peace accord, before they do anything public. They decided to put that aside, and they signed the peace accord with Israel. Now, peace is a term that is usually used after you had war, and there was no war between the Emirates and Israel, or Bahrain and Israel, but still, it's important. Benjamin Netanyahu, as the Israeli paper Yediot Ahronot published, have hidden from the government and from the Minister of Defense and his deputy, Benny Gantz, the fact that the United States promised the UAE to sell them F-35 if they signed the peace deal. And there are voices inside the Israeli army, mainly inside the Israeli Air Force, who say Israel is losing the edge, the technological edge that it used to have upon its enemies or upon other countries in the Middle East. And the question and the problem or the fear is that airplanes, F-35, might proliferate to other countries who are less friendly towards Israel. One word about Saudi Arabia, Israel and the United States, especially the United States, Mr. Kushner and Mr. Pompeo, tried to convince Mohammed bin Salman to stand on stage in Washington in September together with the representative from the UAE in Bahrain and declare that Saudi Arabia will normalize its relations with Israel. Saudi Arabia is the most important country. They are custodians of Islam. If they do that, that's a real diplomatic breakthrough. They offered him a deal that they thought he would not be able to refuse, a visit to Washington. Even in spite of the serious charges about his involvement with the murder of the late Gamal Khashoggi. And they said, even if Biden is elected, a visit to Washington and the meetings cannot be undo. You will be re-legitimized. In spite of that, probably because of internal opposition, probably from the king himself. Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince, said, I agree with everything and I'm happy for all the countries that did normalize, but Saudi Arabia is not yet there.
Okay, so very, very quickly then, many of your, certainly in your military establishment and some in the diplomatic establishment, believe that the eventual existential threat to Israel is no peace with the Palestinians because of the demographics and you know, the things we've talked about many times before. What did Israel take from Mike Pompeo's visit to a settlement in the occupied territories? And does Israel still believe that it has time to annex or to do any of the things that it said, you know, that it wanted to do? Well, what is the future right there?
I am sorry, Christian, but I'm very gloomy on that. What Secretary of State has done today was the official recognition of Israeli annexation, even if the annexation is not yet formal. But being there, sort of protesting, defying any kind of Palestinian claim, that is just another empowerment of any Israeli claim that there is nothing pressuring Israel to sign a peace accord and go to the two-state solution. I think that what we have seen today and the desertment of the UAE, putting aside the Palestinian issue, I think this will get us close to, unfortunately, another outburst of violence from Palestinians towards Israel.
Ronan Bergman, thank you so much for joining us. Now, in the United States, the Black Lives Matter movement started long before this summer's reckoning with racism, but months of protests after the killing of George Floyd put racial justice front and center back into U.S. politics. Patrice Cullors is co-founder of the Black Lives Matter movement, and she wants to meet the incoming administration. Here she is speaking to our Michelle Martin about how they mobilized the black vote in this election and what defund the police really means.
Thanks, Christian. Patrice Cullors, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I'm so glad to be back with you.
Thank you. Likewise. So now people know about Black Lives Matter as a movement, but I'd like to ask you to bring us up to date on how you've sort of solidified Black Lives Matter as an organizing tool. How would you describe your impact on the election? Like, what do you think was the major result of your efforts?
We played a very specific role in this election cycle. We did not stand down. We actually stood up and we created a multi-million dollar Get Out the Vote campaign, where we focused on Black cities and Black towns across the country, including swing states. We reached over 60 million people in that effort, both by ads, phone banking, texting, and by doing drive-in events across the country. I think our movement, and I think our organization alongside Black-led organizers across the country won this election. I do not think that we would have been able to have a Biden-Harris ticket if it weren't for Black-led organizations and Black organizers. We played a really important role. From the very beginning, we understood that we were going to have to help get Black people out to vote, and we were going to have to push Black folks to make sure that we voted for the Biden-Harris ticket. We did this under the Black Lives Matter PAC, and so we started a PAC that where we could do political work, and that was very, very important for us.
So the results of this election are mixed. Your preferred candidate, Joe Biden, Kamala Harris, won the White House. The Democrats increased their numbers in the Senate, but they lost ground in the House and in state legislatures. Republicans now control more state legislatures than at any time in U.S. history. If you can claim credit for the victory, are you willing to take any ownership of the defeats?
You know, I don't think we should take ownership of the defeats only because I think what we've seen specifically with the Republican Party is a really savvy messaging campaign that demonizes Black Lives Matter and aligns the Democratic Party with that demonization. What I haven't seen from the Democratic Party in particular is that same sort of savvy response. And so I do think the Democratic Party should lean on groups like Black Lives Matter. You know, we made the effort to lean into the presidential race, and we really do need the Democratic Party to reach out to us, because we can, I believe, win these other races if they leaned on us just a bit more.
Well, that's interesting. Let's talk about that for a minute, because you know that there's a big discussion about that right now.
Yes.
Among elected Democrats. I know that you're sort of familiar with one of the Democratic representatives, Abigail Spanberger of Virginia, who had a tougher race than I think that perhaps she was expecting. You know, now I think the audio has emerged. There was a kind of conference call where some of the Democrats who consider themselves centrist were saying that, you know, that part of the reason that Democrats lost ground in the House was that they leaned too far into language like defund the police and socialism and all this. So how do you respond to that?
That's not true. Most of the folks who lost did not lean into the fight around defund and did not lean into a more progressive fight that has been on the ground. And so I think, you know, now is the time not to blame the people who helped get us a Biden-Harris ticket. Now is a time to lean on those people and say, hey, how did you do it for this presidential election? Can you come help us do it here at our, you know, at our home and the local elections? And I think that will benefit the Democratic Party way more than they actually understand.
I think her argument is she absolutely didn't lean into defund the police in any of those issues. But her argument was that they basically hung those labels on Democrats who didn't even embrace them. And in fact, as you said, I think they would agree that they demonized Black Lives Matter. How do you defend against that? Do you?
I think it's the wrong question. I think, you know, what we need from the Democratic Party is allyship right now. And we need to actually be working together. And I think the Democratic Party hasn't always engaged our movement in a meaningful way. So, of course, the Republicans are going to win if you don't have any engagement with the real human beings who are leading the defund movement. The moment someone hears me explain defund off of the, you know, outside of the slogan, away from the Republican Party rhetoric, they say, oh, that makes much more sense. And so if there were more alignment, think about AOC, you know, Ilhan, Ayanna Pressley, Rashida Tlaib, Cori Bush, Jamal Bowman, this entire squad did not step away or push back against the movement. They leaned into the movement. They
These are Democrats in safe Democratic seats. These Absolutely. Are Democrats who won their seats by primarying Absolutely. Other Democrats who they did not feel were doing the job. And that's where, so you're not talking about people in swing districts. Look, 70 million people voted for the incumbent.
Yes.
Okay. 76 million people voted for the challenger, for Joe Biden. It could be as many as 80 by the time all the votes are counted. But the reality of it is 70 million people voted for the incumbent. And the Senate is going to be a 50-50 Senate. So the question then becomes is how do you make your case to half the country that either doesn't agree with you or has been successfully persuaded to hate you?
So we persuade folks to actually vote for us. This is what my argument is. My argument is these Democrats did not actually lean into the movement. So the movement was used against them. The movement was also used against us. But instead of aligning with us, sitting with us, talking with us, they have rebuked us. That's also not helpful. It's not helpful to say, well, we lost because of them, but you've never actually sat with us to help us figure out if we could work together. We don't have that other option as part of the option, because the only way that many of these Democrats have talked about us is also demonizing us. And that's what my argument is. We have to try something different. The Democratic Party can't continue to just say that Black Lives Matter or our movement is losing, as contributing to their losses, without actually doing a deep dive into what made them lose. Representative AOC said something really powerful. She said, I did a deeper dive into this argument that the Democratic Party lost because of Black Lives Matter and defund rhetoric. In fact, she said she looked into those races where the Republican Party had a much savvier campaign plan than the Democratic Party, both in the digital space, but also in the ad persuasion space. And so I don't think it's fair to blame us. And I think it actually is a distraction to blame Black Lives Matter for the democratic losses. I think it actually creates more infighting when we don't have to fight. We have to work together. We have many years, 4 years of just terrible policies that we have to undo. And the Democratic Party cannot do it alone. They need all of us.
Not that you're responsible for running all these people's races, but what would have been the right way to address the demonization of Black Lives Matter, the kind of the weaponization of it, as it were?
The way we did it, the way Black Lives Matter did it, is we ran counter ads that actually looked at the human beings behind Black Lives Matter, that reminded people that everyone who wants to talk about, MLK and everyone that wants to talk about the civil rights movement, that this is the modern day civil rights movement. Part of what this is the right has mass media in Fox. The right has all of their right wing magazines and blogs that actually really purport the same messaging. They're very good at spouting out 1 to 2 messages and then hitting us on the head with it. We're not very good at that. And so we have to do a better job at persuading people why we believe the things that we believe and how they're going to not just benefit Black people, but how they're going to benefit everybody.
Before we move on to some other subjects, because I do want to talk about the meeting that you've requested with the incoming administration, is there any space in the Black Lives Matter movement for disagreement over the slogan, defund the police?
Absolutely. Listen, I'll say 2 things on this. Number one, when we came up with Black Lives Matter, the slogan, everybody told us that it was divisive. Mm-hmm. Everybody told us that the Black Lives Matter slogan is going to scare people away, that we were divisive. Why are we saying Black Lives Matter? Why aren't we saying All Lives Matter? And we said over and over again, it is okay to specify the need for the Black community. Every other community gets to do it. Every other community gets to talk about their specific needs. And now in 2020, we have Netflix, we have Amazon and every other corporation saying Black Lives Matter on every screen. Defund the police is a very similar slogan in that it elicits the same kind of response. People are like, why would you say that? Why are you communicating that? Why don't you use another term? I don't think that just because a term is scares people that you don't use it. I think you use a term and then you explain it. You explain why a community is calling for defunding. Because I'll say this, we all know what defunding means. The right has defunded education. The right has defunded folks' access to adequate housing. The right has defunded and divested from healthcare. So the defund slogan only elicits a kind of response, a fear response, because it's specifically about law enforcement. And nobody ever wants to challenge what law enforcement does, because when they do it to Black people, people don't care. So I think this conversation about defund needs to be, needs to have more nuance, and people need to stop playing like they don't understand what it means, because what we are asking for is a reallocation of dollars into a social service network that will actually care for the human beings that have been uncared for over 400 years. Mm.
You asked for a meeting with the Biden-Harris administration. What are you seeking specifically? Do you have some specific type of engagement in mind?
Absolutely. We'd love to sit with them as they're transitioning into elected office. We know what the base of Black people want and need. We've been working with Black folks for years on many different issues. Our organization specifically wants to talk with them about the issues around police violence and mass incarceration. We know that their administration has said they're not interested in defunding, but their administration hasn't actually talked to the movement around what we mean by defunding and what we mean by reallocating funds. And so we'd love to be engaged in a meaningful way to talk about those issues. And lastly, we want them to pass the BREATHE Act. We want them to look at the modern day civil rights legislation that we created with the Movement for Black Lives, to really make sure that the BREATHE Act becomes a reality.
And what does that do? What would it do?
The BREATHE Act is one of the first initiatives that will wholeheartedly look at divesting out of law enforcement and reinvesting into our communities. And so it's a 100-plus page document and bill that details all of the ways that our communities can have access to healthy food, access to adequate education, access to jobs. And we believe that the federal government can help move that forward for us.
Do you have any fears, if I may put it that way, in that, you know, there are those, particularly in the progressive movement, who argue that the Obama administration, in a way, laid the groundwork for the Trump administration for reasons that he couldn't control, which is racism, but some things that he could have perhaps controlled, i.e. that people didn't see enough change in their own lives that made them believe that change is in fact possible. Do you have any of those fears?
Sure, I do. But my biggest fear is, will the country, America, ever want to change? Will it truly want to transform out of being a racist, sexist country? I don't think that happens with one leader. I don't think that happens with one party. I don't think that happens with one president. It's why Black Lives Matter started under Obama, because we didn't see enough change. We didn't feel the change. We were still experiencing so much of the traumas of racism in this country. And so we have a lot of work to do. I do not believe Biden and Harris are saviors. I don't think they'll be able to undo 400 years. I don't know if they're trying to undo 400 years, but our job as leaders, as movement leaders, is to push them and is to also push our local electeds, our statewide electeds, because there's so much more than just the presidential seat and the vice presidential seat. Here in Los Angeles County, we were able to get out DA Jackie Lacey, a DA that had been upholding racism, racist policies, racist ethics inside of our county for so long. We replaced her with a progressive district attorney. And so we need all elected officials. We need all people to show up for this moment. And it's not just going to be the president and the vice president.
Did you ever, Patrice, allow yourself to consider that some people don't think Black Lives Matter?
I do.
And how do you deal with that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do. I get death threats every day reminding me that Black Lives don't matter, and that that folks are willing to kill and maim and abuse, you know, Black people. How I deal with it is by being inside of the movement. How I deal with it is by fighting every single day, and sometimes winning. You know, we have to claim our victories. We have to celebrate when we win. And reminding myself that I'm building a future, not just for me, but for my children and my children's children and their children's children.
There are people who really do believe that, you know, the expression of Black Lives Matter is anti-white. And do you have a message for them?
Yes. I know that when white people historically have said they're pro-white, it is meant that they are anti-Black. And so it must be very confusing to hear Black people say we are pro-Black, and that does not mean that we are anti anything else. But the reality is that Black people's pro-Blackness is about the liberation, not just of Black people, but everybody. We deeply believe that when Black lives actually matter, everybody's lives will also matter. And so that is my message to, you know, white folks in particular who are who really do rely on racism. That racism that you rely on, while it may benefit you in the short term, that is no way to live. That's no way to live your life, and it's no way to teach your children to live. And so there's so much more room when we embrace an anti-racist philosophy, so much more room for humanity.
Patrice Cullors, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Embracing humanity, such an important thought. And finally tonight, we want to leave you with a little light and hope. This 70-year-old retired orchestra teacher, while battling the coronavirus, wanted to also show his gratitude for healthcare workers. And so he played the violin in the ICU, even while intubated and unable to speak. And here's some of that performance. Thanks for watching, and goodbye from London.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.